Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to talk about the fact that the Western financial system is running on a set of obsolete assumptions. And it is doing what I think that the people in the political realm are doing, which is to say they think that if you change the personalities, well, that actually changes something. But all of the arithmetic beneath it is exactly the same. And I wanted to talk both about the US and the UK in this, because, well, in the UK, well, in fact, across the G7, bond yields are moving. And I did a little video on the Daily Channel a couple of days ago explaining basically what that was. I will cover that again in perhaps a little bit more detail here. But also the assumptions why everything is wrong and what the underlying picture actually is. And you know, you can change the, you know, you can put Besant in, you can put Walsh in, you can change Keir Starmer for Andy Burnham. They don't really have any more freedom of movement than they had before the personalities changed. So, I mean, not that I want to discount that something has changed. So, you know, Trump has come in with his tariffs, and it's a program of, you know, reshoring and industrial capacity and, well, energy, defense. It's an explicit break with the old globalist consensus. And we've got Scott Bessent now, and he talks about parallel prosperity, he calls it, which is to say, well, Wall Street has done very well. Now it's the time of Main Street to do well. And we've got Kevin Warsh in as well, of course, the new Fed chair. And he's much more skeptical of continuing Fed intervention and, you know, forward guidance. He's talked about the 2% inflation target being firm, although he's also kind of said, well, actually, it's the left hand side of the decimal place that I'm interested in. Basically, hinting he might go up to 2.9 at some point rather than 2. But nevertheless, you know, rhetorical adherence to the sort of that. So there is real ideological change, and we can't just dismiss it as cosmetic. But then you have to look at what is the system already forcing them to do. And the Treasury announced in August that it was going to be at least doubling its long-end buybacks, meaning that they are buying back debt at the 30-year duration. And they're going to be converting it into short-dated debt. So basically, they're trying to change the shape of the yield curve. It's too expensive up there. We've got a little bit of room back here, so we're going to buy some of those things, swap it into those things, makes long-term money more affordable, beneficial for corporate loans and mortgages and all that sort of stuff. And the Treasury's current quarter is already envisaging up to $38 billion of liquidity support in these buybacks, plus $25 billion of the short-end cash management buybacks. People are arguing that it shouldn't be regarded as money printing in of itself, but it's money printing, effectively. It's not quite yield curve control, but it is liquidity management. And, you know, I don't doubt that the new administration, you know, wants freer and stronger markets, but is also simultaneously becoming involved in keeping the sovereign bond markets from basically not imploding. So the point is this, look, they inherited facts. And you can change the personnel, but it's not going to alter $1.9 trillion of federal deficits this year, which is almost 6% of GDP. It's not going to change the fact that the debt held by the public is 101% of GDP. It's not going to change that the net interest that they have to pay out is 3.3% of GDP. And the CDO baseline is of debt reaching 120% of GDP by 2036. Net interest at 4.6. So getting on for 5%. And so we don't need to frame this as, you know, Trump and Besant and Walsh are the same as the old regime. You know, they may want to change the regime. The problem is that they inherit all of the liabilities from the old regime. So you can change the Treasury Secretary, but you can't change the balance sheet, which he inherits. And, you know, the politics has changed, but the underlying arithmetic hasn't. And Walsh can promise sound money, and Besant can promise Main Street, and Trump can promise factories, but they still have to refinance the debt. So what has changed underneath them? The old system is built around assumptions that used to be true. And so, I mean, those assumptions. I mean, assumption number one is that debt is low enough that rates can discipline inflation. You know, you take 1980, when debt was 26% of GDP. Compare that to today. Debt is 101% of GDP. And as I've just talked about, it will be going a lot higher quite soon. But what that means is that Paul Volcker, the legendary Fed chairman who tamed inflation, he could raise rates brutally without simultaneously repricing a debt stock equal to the entire economy. And today's higher rates eventually feed back into government interest costs, especially as they start to shift more debt into the shorter duration. So when you've got 26% debt, rates can fix inflation. When debt's at 101%, high rates become part of the problem itself. Assumption number two, there will always be plenty of workers. And if you look at Social Security beneficiaries, right? In 1960, it was 5.1 workers per somebody taking out the system. By 2026, today, that's 2.6. You've gone from 5.1 to 2.6, basically halved the number of workers per person paying out. And by 2035, under the baseline assumptions, that's going down to 2.3. But the financial promise hasn't changed. The number of workers standing behind that promise, that's changed. Five workers paid for every one beneficiary. And now you've got 2.5. Right. I'm not making an ideological point. I'm making a division point. This is a straightforward maths problem. Assumption number three, let's go with old people. The assumption is that old people were a relatively small part of assumption of society. You know, Americans over 65 in 2004 would have been 12.4%. Today it's 19%. America already has 61 million people over 65. And the working age population only grew 1.4% from 2020 to 2024, while the over 65s grew 13%. That is a double fiscal hit. Slower taxpayer growth, faster pension and healthcare spending. Assumption number four, globalism. The old assumption was you can continuously get your stuff cheaper by getting somebody else to make it. Ship it abroad, lower energy costs, lower worker costs, move production somewhere cheaper, cheaper goods, lower inflation, therefore you can have lower rates. The new reality, especially with Trump's new politics, is reshoring plus tariffs plus redundant supply chains, defense, energy security. Now, those might be strategically necessary, and I agree that they are, but they're not cheap. If you spend 30 years importing deflation from China, now you want the factories back, fine, good, but the factories don't come back without the deflation going away either. Assumption number five, that your trading partners were not also your geopolitical rivals. You know, economic efficiency doctrine for 30, 40, 50 years was let China make whatever it makes cheapest. And national security is increasingly saying, oh, what if China controls rare earths and batteries and electronics, pharmaceuticals, machine tools, industrial outputs, all of which you need during a conflict. That rather changes the objective, doesn't it? From maximum efficiency to resilience. They are different objective functions. Resilience means duplicating capacity and spare capacity, which means you pay more. China being your factory works beautifully until China becomes your rival. 6. The rest of the world will keep financing the arrangement. And the old loop looked something like this. It was US imports goods, foreigners accumulate dollars, foreigners buy US assets, US treasuries, and US borrowing stays cheap. Because it's a cycle. They make it, earn it, send it back. China's treasury holdings are now $633 billion versus $733 only a year earlier. And both of those numbers are well below their historic peak. And the dollar remains overwhelmingly important, sure. Still 57.1% of disclosed FX reserves. So we can't oversell the de-dollarization thing. Fine. But if America wants less dependency on foreign production, can it still expect the same foreign capital recycling that accompanies that production? I think, obviously not. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. That's not going to happen. If you want China out of the factories, fine. But if the factories and the financing were part of the same deal, well, you're not getting that deal anymore. So in every case, if I can remember what order I did those in, the assumption was low debt, now we've got high debt. The assumption was many workers, now we've got few workers. It was few retirees and now we've got many retirees. It was we're offshoring and now it's we're reshoring. It was, okay, we've got trading partners and now it's like, oh shit, they're actually strategic rivals. And we did have foreign financing and now we've got less reliable foreign financing, to put it fairly mildly. Then every assumption that made the old system affordable is being revised at the same time. Which brings me on to, if those are the actual realities, what would we have to do to make the financial system work again? What would actually fix it? And I suppose more to the point, why will politicians not fix it? So to stabilize the finances, America's going to need some combination of spending less, taxing more, retiring later, reducing entitlement, grow productivity much faster. Maybe AI and robotics can help them do that, but you need to do that. And accepting higher real rates. Well, and the recession and asset losses required to clear the excesses out while you're making that transition. So the difficulty in all of that is not the economics, it's not the maths. Perfectly bloody straightforward. Anybody who knows a little bit of finance and economics can work that out for you. The difficulty is deciding who is going to take the loss. And the budget is increasingly made of things politicians do not want to touch. Federal spending is $4.5 trillion of mandatory programs. Discretionary spending is only $1.9 trillion. Net interest of getting on for a trillion. And from 2027 to 2036, Social Security and Medicare are going to account for 81% of the projected increases in that mandatory spending. So you can cut foreign aid, bureaucracy, DEI programs. Yeah, very good. Do all of that. Right, doesn't solve the problem. The big money is pensions, healthcare, and interest. And in the American case, bit of military after that. Well, quite a lot of military, actually. So you can fire every diversity officer in Washington, right, and your Medicare bill still turns up. That is the core problem. And Social Security is already telling you the choice. My old age Social Security trust fund is projected to deplete in 2032. Right, and at that point, existing income only covers the first 78%. Of the bill. Combined the lot of Social Security, And we're at, by 2034, only the first 83% is covered. So in reality, once you break out the old calculator, there are only, you know, a few real choices. Cut benefits, raise retirement age, raise payroll taxes, or fund the difference from trying to figure out how to tax more and borrow more.